Good morning, folks. Sorry about the change of plans, but fortunately, Colonel Anderson and his son and Ron over here volunteered to fill in for it. We'll have the other show this Friday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for the mosquito. We got Colonel Anderson on my left, Colonel Anderson on my further left, and Ron on the end. This is Ron's beautiful airplane, and as Connie said, he's responsible for a good bit of what we have here, the Quonset Hut and what have you. And we'll get to talk a little bit later about his museum. And first of all, I'd like to, Colonel Anderson Jr. here, why aren't you Clarence Jr.? Why are you called Jim?
That's a pretty interesting story. I didn't learn who I was named after until I was almost 50 years old. I think it was very typical of the World War II generation. My father never really talked much about the war. My sister and I knew he had shot down some airplanes, and I remember playing in his World War II leather helmet when I was a little kid, but I didn't really know that much. So when he sent me the manuscript from the book, I learned that I was named after two pilots that my father flew with in the war that were killed, James Browning from Kansas and Eddie Simpson from New Jersey. Both great guys. Jim Browning really didn't have to be there. He was on his second tour, end of the war, and he was killed in a mid-air collision with a German jet, ME-262. And I was very, very fortunate. About 3 years ago, they found pieces of his crash site, and I was hiking in Switzerland, and two German policemen that found it contacted me, and I was able to go up near Frankfurt and visit the crash site and get pieces for my father, and I made a shadow box for him. Eddie Simpson had to bail out over France just after D-Day, and he went with the French underground, and he was doing real well, but then the Germans discovered where the French underground camp was, and he was in a convoy trying to escape the Germans who were chasing him. He was in the last vehicle, and the Germans were gaining on the convoy as they were trying to escape. And so they pulled over and stopped, and two French gentlemen jumped out with a machine gun to hold off the Germans. And Eddie jumped out with them, and he died there. And that wasn't really discovered until the 50s after the war. Nobody really knew, you know, what had happened to Eddie, but that's how I got named.
Okay, and I forgot to say that Colonel Anderson here is an Academy graduate, Air Force Academy in 1969. He's flown the O-2, the T-33, T-38, F-4E, and F-5, and he's currently retired again. He flew 20 years for Southwest, 16 and a half years, and 20 years in the Air Force, and 9.5 years he taught at Arizona State. What did you teach?
I was in the aviation program.
He was in the aviation. I thought maybe he taught math or something like that. But Colonel Anderson, would you like to start your video now? Would you like to start your video now?
Sure. Let's see. Let me get my slides up.
May 27, 1944. Bud Anderson's four P-51 Mustangs escort an American bombing mission. Now, relive the dogfight as he faces a flight of deadly German ME-109s. Anderson has one advantage that the fighters of World War I lacked. Improvements in electronics now allow planes to carry a radio.
We hear on the radio that up front, ahead of us, there were being attack. My wingman's on the inside. He calls out, hey, we got four bogies, unidentified airplanes, attacking us, coming down on us from 5 o'clock high. We're very vulnerable.
The opening moves of a dogfight are critical. Anderson can go left, right, straight, climb, or dive. If Bud turns left, he's in the angle of attack. If he goes straight, the Messerschmitt, its dive giving it superior speed, will overtake him. His only hope is to break right. the German is going too fast to make the sharp turn.
So we turn like this very hard.
Bud's flight does a half circle, then goes head on toward the Germans. The two groups pass each other. The Germans turn left, so do the Mustangs. It's a lethal game of hunter and hunted as each side tries to get on the other's vulnerable 6 o'clock.
Now we got four ME-109s. We got four Mustangs coming around. They want to fight. So they're coming around. And we're coming around now in a big left circle. This goes about two times. Each time we come around, I'm a little closer to getting in trail with them. So we've turned their advantage now to our advantage.
Bud is here. The Germans are here. The Mustang's tighter turn gives them an inside track. The smaller turning radius allows the Mustangs to close in. Anderson's plan? Use this advantage to get on the ME-109's tail. Line up, fire.
You do all this stuff by instinct. You don't have it all figured out. You do it instinctively.
The Mustang's 450 caliber machine guns carry nearly 1,300 rounds, but that's just 20 seconds of ammo. Anderson needs to make every shot count.
We were all young, indestructible. I hope. I knew it was a lie, but you had to think that way.
The Germans spot the Mustangs closing the range and make a run for it. But with a top speed of 441 miles per hour, the Mustang is over 50 miles per hour faster than the ME-109. Then one German breaks away from the pack and climbs.
I'm looking at this guy, and I don't want to get too far up or he can drop down on me.
Anderson sends two of his Mustangs, led by Eddie Simpson, after it. Bud and his wingman, John Scarra, stay after the other three ME-109s. Bud uses the Mustang's superior speed and gets within 300 yards of the Messerschmitt.
When you shoot somebody down, the best way to do it is to get right here, what we call 6 o'clock. That's what I did with this guy.
The wounded 109 does something that amazes Anderson. He keeps flying upside down.
And I thought, what the heck's he doing, you know? If he's going to run away, he just would roll over and pull away. I'm sitting there right side up very comfortably and pump some more shells into him.
It was Anderson's sixth kill of the war. It's now two against two. Bud can tell the Germans are nervous. Their planes twitch as the pilots strain, pulling on the stick as they look over their shoulders. One German dives to escape. The other climbs and turns. He still wants to fight. Clearly, one experienced dogfighter.
When you saw a German airplane, you treated him like the Red Baron. I mean, you used every advantage you had over him, and without the knowledge of knowing who was in that airplane.
Bud tries to follow the ME-109. The German turns a hard left. Bud realizes he's going too fast to make the turn. He passes the German and climbs, trying to gain the advantage. Bud is now above the German. If the German continues to turn, Bud can drop on him. If he dives, Anderson can give chase. But the ME-109 skillfully reverses his turn, pulls a hard right, and gets behind the Mustangs. Bud is in front. His wingman, John Scarra, is right behind. It's now Scarra who has the German on his tail. Anderson tells Scarra to dive, hoping the German will follow.
I'll drop in behind him. Maybe we can get him that way. So John did that. sure enough, boy, he went right after him.
At over 400 miles per hour, Bud dives after the ME-109 that's still on Scara's tail.
He sees that right away. He comes on, straightens out, pulls away. Then he comes around on this hard turn again.
The German has pulled the same maneuver. Left turn, hard right. Using Bolka's fifth rule, he's now on Bud's tail.
Now I've got the problem. So I pull the airplane up as steep as I want to, full power, got everything just going as I can. I know that I've got a little more energy than it is, but I'm thinking about plan B.
In Bud's head, he knows that energy, or airspeed, is life. Anderson's in trouble. It's the only time in his Air Force career that an enemy fighter is behind him, almost making a perfect attack.
Here you are, one-on-one, kill or be killed. There's big odds that you might not make it. He might be killed in this thing. And you wonder inside, how am I going to perform personally? Am I going to run or am I going to fight? You don't know. I mean, you can train, but the actual thing is real. It's real.